Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for April 23rd, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the effects of teacher quality on early reading, a chronology of Asian monsoons and megadrought, and a new resource for ecology research. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how good dogs live longer, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
According to past research, children who fail to read proficiently are more likely to be held back in school, drop out, and even commit crimes. But there's been some doubt as to whether a good teacher makes any difference in a child's reading proficiency, or if reading achievement is rather influenced by the child's genetics, family life, and the larger school environment. In a paper in this week's Science, Jeanette Taylor and colleagues confirm that genes do indeed make a difference in children's oral reading fluency, but that teacher quality does too. In particular, the team reports that when children receive more effective instruction, they will tend to develop at their optimal trajectory. In addition, poor teaching impedes the ability of children to reach their potential. I spoke with Taylor from her office at Florida State University.
We found that genes certainly do have an effect on early reading skills, but so does teacher quality, and that teacher quality has the chance to maximize potential of children's reading gains.
What test were you and your team using to assess teacher quality?
We calculated an index based on the same measure that we used for the twins, and it's a standardized test called oral reading fluency, and it's just a timed measure of how many words children can read within a passage. So it's got a context to it. It's not just words on a list. And we used those scores from the classmates of the twins to assess the quality or effectiveness of the twins' teachers. So it wasn't based on the twin scores themselves, but on their classmate scores. And it was essentially a change or a residual index such that it was over time, over the course of the school year, how much gain in reading, words per minute, was achieved by the class given the initial level. So it's over and above what would be expected based on the class's initial level. And we felt that that was a reasonable estimate of teacher effectiveness because the scores ranged from, you know, very low scores, 11 words per minute, 8 words per minute. That was the total gain of the class over the school year, which I wouldn't say is very effective, to, you know, 120, 130, 140 words per minute. That was the gain over time in the children's performance on this test.
Did you and your team have enough participants, enough twins, to statistically control for things like socioeconomic status, parental education levels, gender of the student and teachers?
Right. We didn't control for those things other than, I guess, we took advantage of the fact that the sample is diverse economically so that we had a range, and that's, we needed to take advantage of that because in a restricted range, if let's say we only had a sample from upper middle class counties in Florida where the income is quite high and you'd expect that to be correlated with high parental education, there may not be the kind of effects that we saw because you might expect that teaching and schools are uniformly good because they have a lot of resources and, you know, parental involvement. Well, we had the full range, so we didn't want to control for that or partial that out. We needed to actually take advantage of that. And so one of the nice things about the study is that the measured environmental variable is teacher effectiveness, but not based on anything that we got from the twins or their parents. So it wouldn't be as confounded with genetics as other environmental measures could be.
What, if any, differences then were there in the oral reading fluency scores when the twins were in the same class with the same teacher?
Yeah, if you looked at twins who had the same teacher versus those who didn't, there was more similarity amongst the twins. So that was an analysis that's not reported in the paper, but it's one of the one thing that we looked at, which would get at the potential for teacher to serve as a shared environmental influence. And what we saw was that there was greater similarity, suggesting this shared environment or common environmental influence. But we noticed that the data, we have data at 3 to 4 times per year on these same measures for these twins. And the differences that we saw, you could see those from the beginning, at least in the first and second grade. And we didn't know if that was attributable in part to the confound of tracking, where students are placed either by their teacher or by the school or by the parents' request to have the kids in the same classroom, have a certain teacher, have a, you know, that kind of thing. And we felt like that was probably not the most effective way to look at our data, was to compare kids with the same classroom versus not. And also in part because there was a study that just came out, I think it was last year, from a large study that goes on in the United Kingdom on reading, that showed that even identical twins in the same classroom have different experiences, that they show significant differences in their experience of the classroom and sometimes in their achievement and things like that. So we preferred to go with this different approach where we looked at the interaction. So teacher quality, does it have a direct influence as an environmental variable on the sources of variance in reading ability? So these genetic, shared environmental, non-shared environmental sources of variability, are those influenced by this measured environmental variable of teacher quality? So that's what we ended up thinking was probably better suited to our data.
To what degree, then, are teachers having an impact on student reading achievement?
Yeah. You know, data from non-twins that are out there in the education literature, and one of the nice things about this paper is that it's a true collaboration among folks that come from different perspectives. So we've got, you know, me, the behavioral geneticist, and we've got education researchers in the group and folks focused on reading research in particular. And we know that the literature on non-twins shows a admittedly, it doesn't appear to be a huge effect in terms of controlling for other things, but that there's an effect of teacher quality on reading gains and on reading achievement. And what we tried to do was say, does that influence the genetic piece that we know other studies have also shown? And so can we see that effect? And certainly the effect was there. So the moderation is there. That's what our data seem to show, that there's this interaction such that at high, high levels of teacher quality, yet the extreme tail of the distribution, you're going to see variability in children's reading being accounted for much more by genetics. So it's going to highlight those genetic differences and allow kids to probably reach those potentials, whatever they are. But at the lowest end of teacher quality, you're going to see those genetic differences are much smaller in terms of how much they're associated with the differences between kids in their ability to read. So most people are going to be in that middle range, right? They're going to be in that middle range, and you're going to get this genetic influence. And our data are just helpful, I think, in helping us modify what we know about genetic influence on reading, in that it is influenced by this teacher quality variable. Our MZ analyses, our identical twin analyses, where we were able to look at a number of pairs who didn't match up in terms of their reading ability. One of the members of the identical twin pair was above the group mean for the whole sample, and the other twin, the co-twin, who's genetically identical, was below the mean. So they were discordant in their reading ability performance. And when we looked at teacher quality, there was a significant difference there too, of, you know, close to 10 points difference in teacher quality on average. So that the member of the pair performing better had the better quality teachers.
Was that effect greater for when each twin was in his or her own class compared to when each twin was in the same class with the same teacher?
For the identical twin analyses where they were what we call discordant, or they didn't have similar scores, one was above the mean of the group and the other one was below, so a higher performer and lower performer, we only compared those kids who had different teachers. Because if they had the same teacher, they would have had the exact same teacher score or quality score, and so there wouldn't have been a difference for that. So we only looked at the kids with different teachers who were discordant. It is possible, it was possible in the database that there could have been identical twins who also were discordant within a classroom. So they had the same teacher, but nonetheless weren't performing at the same level. I don't think we looked for those, but that's possible. And again, that goes back to that issue of, it doesn't mean that identical twins will even experience the same teacher the exact same way. But it is possible that in our big sample that there were a few pairs that shared a teacher, but were nonetheless discrepant. And that would be an interesting separate question of why are they different? But again, we have only the data from their achievement scores.
Any insights then from this study on what the higher quality teachers, as measured by this study, are doing in the classroom so that other teachers might employ the same teaching strategies?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, I'd hate to not give an answer, but our study, we really only looked at the gains of the kids in class. So, you know, one of the things that we've talked about, or my co-authors and I, in terms of finding this greater genetic variability at this high end of teacher quality measure, is that, you know, it could point to the idea that there are some things that good teachers do alike. So I think it highlights that we definitely should be looking for those kind of factors, and perhaps there'd be a point where we could get a little more nuanced in our investigation and learn a little bit more about the kinds of methods that are used by the teachers that at least their kids are making big gains according to our index. So I hate to not give an answer, but we are certainly limited in terms of what we have since we really only had scores from the kids in the class, twins and non-twins.
Jeanette Taylor, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much.
Jeanette Taylor of Florida State University is lead author of a paper on how teacher quality moderates the genetic effects on early reading. Read the paper and a special section on literacy in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, an unscientific poll about unconventional journals. We'd like your thoughts about whether the benefits of a non-peer-reviewed journal, such as Medical Hypotheses, outweigh the risks. Here's what the poll is about. According to the Medical Hypotheses Journal's website, the journal will consider speculative and non-mainstream scientific ideas, provided they are coherently expressed. But the journal has drawn fire for publishing papers that some say are detrimental to healthcare efforts. For example, one paper published by the journal denied the link between HIV and AIDS. In this week's Science, find letters that argue for and against the unconventional journal's position on publishing speculative ideas, and our poll to ask you what you think. Find our unscientific poll about unconventional journals on our website, www.sciencemag.org, and click on Take Our Readers Poll. Drought is a normal part of the climate for almost every part of the world, but when droughts go on year after year, they can greatly upset human settlements and even put an end to entire civilizations. For example, historical records show that past mega droughts in Asia coincide with the end of China's Ming Dynasty. And in a paper in this week's Science, Ed Cook and colleagues report that the end of the Khmer civilization in what is now Cambodia also coincided with a mega drought. The research team reconstructed the chronology of hundreds of years of Asian monsoon droughts based on a network of tree ring data, providing a long-term context for monsoon variability. I spoke with Cook from his office at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University in New York.
What we've done is provide the first spatial reconstruction of the Asian monsoon complex, the rather complicated varieties of the Asian monsoon that strike India, China, and Southeast Asia, and down even into Australasia. And we've done that from a network of long tree ring chronologies.
How does your team's model based on tree ring chronologies compare to models based on ice cores or corals or other proxy data?
What makes our product quite different is that we can provide an actual spatial representation of Asian monsoon variability. Records like ice cores and speleothems, for example, are extremely useful.
These are cave deposits, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, speleothems are cave deposits. And those records are extremely useful, but they tend to be at fixed locations with not enough locations being available typically to provide a spatial representation of monsoon variability. The tree ring network that we developed, 327 chronologies in total, basically cover most of the region affected by the Asian monsoon system. And consequently, our tree ring network can be used to reconstruct patterns of drought variability over the region back in time.
How did you and your team calibrate or test your team's model?
What we do is we first assemble the network of tree ring chronologies, of course, and then we also obtain through various sources the gridded instrumental data that we use for calibrating the tree rings in terms of a particular climate variable, in this case, summer monsoon drought variability. The instrumental climate data we used was the Palmer Drought Severity Index for the June, July, August summer monsoon season. And it's a 534 grid point array of data points spaced 2.5 degrees by 2.5 degrees across the Asian monsoon region. And we can calibrate this grid of drought indices, or use this grid to calibrate the tree rings, such that at each grid point, we have a tree ring reconstruction of drought. And this provides us with the spatial details back in time.
And how far back does that Palmer Index go?
Well, the instrumental data goes back with quality back to about 1951, and then it degrades in quality back in time further. But it does go back as far as 1870, the particular data set for instrumental records. The tree rings, however, can take us back hundreds of years into the past. And in fact, what we present in our science paper is a set of drought reconstructions that go back to 1300, approximately 700 years in the past.
What, if any, insights have you and your team gleaned from your chronology of Asian monsoons and looking at the time period of known historical droughts?
Well, what we've done is to try to do some preliminary evaluations of monsoon failures and mega droughts in our reconstructions and how they might compare to what is in the 20th century record of recorded drought variability from rain gauges and such. And we find that when one goes back in time, back as far as 700 years, there are some clear periods of very unusual drought, monsoon failure, that is certainly as significant or more significant in strength compared to anything that's indicated in the instrumental records for the 20th century.
Does your chronology show any patterns or conditions that might have led to the mega droughts or monsoon failure?
Yeah, the best we can tell right now is that there's a fairly tight coupling, as it were, between what happens in the tropical Pacific Ocean, what the tropical Pacific sea surface temperatures are doing, and what happens to the monsoon in various regions of Asia. It's basically related to the El Nino Southern Oscillation System that is well known for controlling hydroclimatic variability over large parts of the globe. The summer monsoon in Asia, particularly in India and Southeast Asia, is quite sensitive to sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific. And that seems to be driving a lot of the variability we think we see in terms of changes in wetness and dryness or strength of the monsoon.
Beyond insights into historical droughts, what, if any, new insights does your team's tree ring-based chronology provide as to the conditions or patterns that led to other weather conditions that aren't in the historical record?
Well, we're still just evaluating the reconstructions themselves. We haven't gone too deeply into it, but the real significance of this product, the Monsoon Asia Drought Atlas, relates to how it can be used as a tool for modeling studies to better understand the actual mechanisms or processes that lead to the monsoons varying the way they do or have in the past and also now and hopefully even in the future. The Drought Atlas, the Monsoon Asia Drought Atlas, provides the spatial patterns of variability that modelers need to really understand the mechanisms and processes that are responsible for the reconstructed variability. And I think that's going to be the big payoff, is coming up with improved models that can be used to understand and even perhaps to predict monsoon variability in the future.
What would you say to a skeptic who might say that our mucking with the climate means analyzing past data won't help in predicting the future?
Well, there's an element of truth to that in the sense that, you know, we could, for example, be entering into a kind of a no analog state of climate variability due to unusual greenhouse gas forcing. On the other hand, the underlying processes of climate variability are still the same. And so to better understand and to model variability even in the future requires an understanding of the processes and the dynamics that go into monsoon variability. And that can be understood from the past, even though conditions today might be different. And models can take into account that changing state in terms of forcing, as the models do, you know, routinely in understanding what's happening today and perhaps what will happen in the future. So I don't think it's a limitation per se that the conditions in the past are not quite the same as they are today with respect to the forcings involved.
Ed Cook, thank you very much.
You bet.
Ed Cook of the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University is lead author of a paper on Asian monsoon failure and mega drought during the last millennium. For decades, the astronomy and geosciences communities have worked with funding agencies to build costly telescopes and enormous ships, all without devouring their annual budgets. Now, the ecology community in the United States is preparing to do the same thing by constructing a network of observational sites to track long-term ecological change on a continental scale. But as Science's Elizabeth Panisi reports in this week's issue, success of the over $400 million project will depend on whether ecologists can change how they do science.
So this story is about the National Ecological Observatory Network, which is a new program established by the National Science Foundation to monitor the environment across the whole United States. It's a program that's been in the making for a decade now, has undergone various permutations in terms of what it should look like and what it should do and how it should operate. But it's getting to the point now where they're almost ready to actually start building. And it will be a network of 20 main sites and about 40 secondary sites that will have the same kind of environmental monitoring with the same kind of instruments on the same schedule to gather data that you can compare across all the sites.
How are the sites distributed?
The sites are distributed across the United States. They went through a process where they evaluated all sorts of climate and vegetation and other kinds of data information about what the environments were in different parts of the country. And in fact, they had a kilometer by kilometer analysis where they would sort of build a matrix of all these variables and figure out what areas are most like each other and sort of cluster them into what they call domains. And they came up with 20 domains across the country that represent different ecosystems, more or less, across the whole United States, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and Alaska.
So how is this National Ecological Observatory Network different from previous ecological monitoring projects?
This project, whose acronym is NEON, is meant to be a 30-year project because they want to have long-term data so you can actually follow the environment long enough to see if there are any trends or any changes. It's not the first time that NSF has gone into long-term ecological research. The National Science Foundation has had another long-term ecological research project called the Long-Term Ecological Research Network that has been going on for 30 years, but which was done on a piece-by-piece basis. So in other words, a researcher in Colorado would make a proposal to NSF saying, I want to establish a long-term research project in this mountain range, and NSF would approve it, and he or she would do the experiments that they wanted to do and do the kind of monitoring that they wanted to do. And maybe someone in Virginia would do another long-term ecological research place, but would do a different set of experiments and do a different set of measurements in a different way. And so there's no way to compare what you find in Colorado with what you find in Virginia. And NEON is meant to get around that, in other words, because everybody is doing the same thing, the same measurements, so you can compare.
What kind of monitoring will all these stations be doing?
Well, there's a variety of things. There'll be monitoring of sort of weather and climate parameters. They'll be monitoring carbon dioxide flux. Then there's also a biological component where they'll be catching insects and trapping mice and digging up microbes and sequencing the microbes to see what's there. There'll be vegetation surveys. They're also planning to do airplane flyovers where they'll take pictures with cameras, and they have these sensitive instruments that look at the chemistry of the vegetation so you can tell basically how green the vegetation is, how much productivity there is. So there's a pretty extensive list of stuff that they'll be studying.
So in setting up this project, did researchers have a model for creating an observatory network on a national scale, or is this something new, internationally even?
This is something new. I don't know if anybody's done anything internationally, but for the United States, this is something brand new.
With something so new, what, if anything, are project organizers saying it will take for NEON, this National Ecological Observatory Network, to succeed?
Well, NEON is different for ecologists because ecologists are used to working on their own, gathering their own data, sort of doing their own thing. And NEON is different in that NEON and NEON personnel will be actually gathering the data and providing a lot of different data for any researcher to use. So the ecologist doesn't have the same control over the data that he or she might normally have. So it requires a sort of a change in mindset from ecologists, number one, to sort of accept data that they didn't gather. Number two, to think in terms of national scale or regional scale instead of thinking in terms of the particular study site where you were working. So it's a little bit of a risk because nobody really knows exactly how to use these data, and nobody knows whether ecologists will be lining up to take advantage of it.
What's been the reaction of the ecologist you spoke with to this large-scale environmental science project?
The reaction was mixed. I mean, a lot of people are very enthusiastic about it. They think this is what's needed to sort of make the next step in ecology and to sort of make the next leap in understanding global climate change. Some people were a little bit wary of the amount of money that it's going to cost. It's an over a $400 million project, which is huge from the ecological research point of view. And some people think that observing is not enough. They would rather see global climate change experiments going on, and the number of global climate change experiments that will go on at these different sites is limited.
So a real change then for people who are even considering going into ecology as to what to expect.
Right. This is new age ecology in the way that genomics is new age genetics. And the idea is that this is something for young scientists to think about devoting their careers to, thinking in terms of how you take advantage of all these data, how you think about things on a national scale. It'll be an exciting opportunity for young people.
Elizabeth Panisi, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Science's Elizabeth Panisi reports on the National Ecological Observatory Network and the new standard for tracking long-term ecological change across the United States. As reported in the New York Times last week, the number of women dying in childbirth has dropped dramatically from about 526,000 in 1980 to about 343,000 in 2008. The source of the figures comes from a paper put out by The Lancet. Here with more about it is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
The new figures are surprising because the approximate number of maternal deaths has appeared to hold steady for decades, leading to a widespread perception of little progress in the field. The World Health Organization's latest figures still put maternal deaths at about 500,000 per year. The new study cited several reasons for the positive findings, including lower pregnancy rates in some countries, better nutrition and access to health care, more education for women, and an increase in the availability of trained professionals to assist with births. As for the drastic difference between the new stats and previous estimates, Lancet editor Richard Horton says his journal's study was based on more and better data, as well as more sophisticated statistical methods. He also says he was pressured to delay his journal's findings while public health officials readied to ask for maternal health aid at upcoming United Nations meetings. This is one of those instances, he told the New York Times, when science and advocacy can conflict.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how good dogs live longer. Their disposition has an effect, Dave?
It turns out it does, Rob. This story is all about what factors make certain species live longer than others. You know, why does an elephant live for years and mice only live for months? And it's a hard thing to test because a lot of this may have happened via natural selection. You know, there may have been certain traits that were selected for that maybe conferred a certain advantage to an animal, maybe making it more aggressive, but being more aggressive made it a better hunter and maybe was able to procure food better, but also maybe that same trait also shortened its lifespan because it was so aggressive, maybe that its heart beat really fast and that really increased its metabolism and caused it to run out its lifespan a lot faster than maybe another animal would.
So natural selection versus people selection.
Well, right. This is a hard theory to test because we can't just take a bunch of animals and naturally select them ourselves over millions of years and figure out what happens. But dogs have been a nice natural experiment because we have been, as you say, self-selecting these animals for over 10,000 years for specific traits, like, you know, some dogs have been bred to be good hunting dogs, and some dogs have just been bred for looking nice on a couch. And so what a researcher did in this study was to look at various breeds of dogs and see if there was any correlation between personality and lifespan. And that's actually what he found. He found that obedient dogs like German Shepherds and Bichon Frises actually live very long for their size, whereas hard-to-train dogs like Beagles and Pomeranians generally died earlier than similarly sized breeds. And what's more, the researcher also found that peaceful dogs like Newfoundlands, which are these really large dogs, and Labradors tend to burn less energy per kilogram than really aggressive dogs do, like Fox Terriers and Great Danes. And so what the researcher thinks is, you know, this is all correlation, but what he saw is that these dogs with these sort of more peaceful, more obedient personalities tended to be the types of dogs that lived longer for their size range than dogs on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Are researchers willing to extend this hypothesis or extend this correlation to other species like us?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. There's nothing in this study to indicate that this has any application to humans, whether more peaceful or I don't know how you would define an obedient human, but definitely more easygoing humans might live longer. Although we do know that stress can be an important factor for shortening lifespan. So it's possible that there are some implications for humans as well.
Okay, so what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from personality in dogs to intelligence in birds, and specifically crows, this next story is all about a type of crow known as the New Caledonian crow, which is actually known as a feathered ape because it has been demonstrated to be very smart in a lot of previous experiments.
What kind of smartness are we talking about here?
Well, believe it or not, there have been some studies that have shown that these crows can actually understand some rudimentary physics and that they can actually recognize themselves and other humans. We actually, a while ago in a podcast...
Oh, right. I remember they were attacking people who were wearing Dick Cheney masks.
Exactly. And so we know these crows are smart. The question is, how smart are they? And one classic experiment that's been done with these crows is to show that they can use tools. Researchers give them a stick and they use the stick to maybe probe down a hole and get a worm out of it. And actually, that is not so unique to crows. In fact, other animals, even ants, can use tools. But what was interesting with crows is that researchers showed that if they gave crows a really small stick, say a stick that couldn't get all the way down a hole to get a worm, the crows could use that small stick to get a larger stick, and then they would use that larger stick to get the worm. And researchers had claimed from this study, which was conducted a couple years ago, that not only does this show that crows are smart because they know how to use tools, but that they actually are capable of this higher cognition, of this ability to sort of plan ahead. They're not just saying, hey, I need a tool to get that worm. They're saying, hey, I need this tool to get that tool, and that tool is going to help me get a worm. This really complex flow of logic, researchers say, you know, you've really only seen that in primates.
But other scientists called that into doubt?
Exactly. A lot of other scientists had said, some skeptics of the study had said, you guys are really sort of overinterpreting this result. And what their criticism was is that when the crows were given this smaller stick, they weren't really thinking ahead that, hey, the smaller stick is going to help me get the larger stick, which is going to help me get the worm. They just associated this smaller stick with the eventual food reward. So they saw the small stick as something good that helped them get the larger stick and that helped them get the worm.
So they saw the small stick as a good thing, the larger stick as a good thing. Whatever the case, just go get the good thing.
Exactly. The skeptic said this is all just an association. You know, one good thing gets me another good thing. And, you know, there is some intelligence there. It doesn't really represent a complex sort of planning or being able to follow this flow of logic that researchers have associated with humans and other primates.
So what about this new study?
Well, this new study is all about an attempt to get around that problem. What researchers did was they said, let's get crows to really hate this small stick. You know, if these skeptics are saying that these crows are just using the small stick because they like it or they associate it with food, let's get them to really dislike it, to view it as what they call an unattractive object, and see if they can still use it in the same way. So what they did is they took a few crows and they gave them the small stick, and they also presented the crows with something to use the stick on. They would, you know, put a treat in a hole or behind a cage, and the crows could never get this treat because the stick was too small. So they would try to use the stick and they would give up after a few attempts. And in fact, they would actually have behaviors that indicated they really disliked this stick. After a few attempts, they would sort of throw the stick away or toss it down. They really came to dislike the stick exactly as researchers hoped they would. And then what researchers did was they repeated this classic experiment where they gave these crows again the small stick, but this time the crows could use the small stick to get a larger stick to get the reward. But they made things even more unattractive for the small stick. So already they knew the crows didn't like this small stick anymore. But now they tied this small stick to a rope on a branch. So not only did the crows have to get the stick that they didn't really like, they really had to go through a lot of machinations to get this stick. And what the researchers found was that even though the crows didn't like the small stick and the small stick was really hard to get, when the crows realized that they could use the small stick to get a larger stick to get their reward, they used it. And there's actually a really cool video in the story, which I highly encourage everybody to take a look at. This is a video of a female crow. And what's really special about her is a lot of these other crows I just talked about, they had to make a few attempts with the small stick and the larger stick before they really got the hang of knowing, okay, the small stick is going to get me the larger stick, which is going to get me the reward. But you'll see in this video, there's a female crow that basically looked at the whole setup. She saw the small stick hanging from the tree. She saw the large stick on a table, and she saw the food reward hidden behind something that she could only get with a large stick. And without any trial and error, after sort of staring at the setup for a couple minutes, she goes ahead. She goes straight to that small stick, grabs it, goes to the big stick, grabs that, and uses the big stick to get the reward. So she worked out this whole thing in her mind, didn't have to fail at all, and got everything on the first try. You can see all this happening in the video.
So does this convince researchers that that's what's going on inside the crow's brain?
Well, you know, it's hard to say whether this is going to convince all the skeptics. At least one outside expert thought this was a very powerful experiment. The researchers do say, though, that it does really address this criticism of the previous study that, you know, the crows were just using these small sticks because they were making these positive associations with them. And it really does get us further along the lines of being able to claim that maybe animals that we don't think are as intelligent as humans or other primates, like birds, actually might be capable of this very advanced cognition.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, I feel like we're working our way down the food chain here a little bit, but this last story is about fish and specifically mercury levels in tuna. And this study is claiming that the tuna that you get in sushi at restaurants actually has a lot more mercury in it than the tuna-filled sushi that you would get at a supermarket.
Why the difference?
Well, the difference has to do with the type of tuna that's actually used in these different types of sushi. And nobody had really done a comprehensive study of it before. You know, researchers knew that, you know, there's a few tuna species that tend to end up in sushi. And why tuna itself tends to accumulate so much mercury in the first place is that the species at the top of the food chain in the ocean, the higher up you are in the food chain, the more animals you've eaten who themselves have eaten more animals. And if you've got mercury starting at the lowest levels, this really builds up a lot. And especially if you're talking about something like a bluefin tuna, which can weigh more than 500 kilograms, you're talking about potentially a lot of mercury accumulating in these fish.
So the restaurants serve tuna from these larger fish than the ones in the supermarket.
Exactly. And they tend to serve sushi that has tuna from species that accumulate more of this mercury. And in fact, what the researchers did here, which really hadn't been done before, is they employed something called DNA barcoding. And they essentially took samples of tuna. They took 100 sushi samples from 54 restaurants and 15 supermarkets. And what DNA barcoding does is it basically, it allows you to look for specific genetic markers that would distinguish one species from the next. And what they found was they found that, you know, when you combine restaurant tuna and supermarket tuna, you're talking about five species. And what the team found was that restaurant sushi tends to contain big-eye tuna or lean bluefin tuna. And these types of tuna had concentrations of mercury that are actually 4% above what the FDA recommended limit is for mercury. And the reason we care about mercury is it's been shown to cause severe neurological problems in humans, especially can be a real problem for pregnant women and young children. And researchers found that the type of tuna that's usually found in supermarkets is yellowfin tuna, which tends to be cheaper and some more plentiful species, but it contains less mercury than restaurant tuna, but it still exceeds the FDA limits for mercury. So even with the supermarket tuna, you're getting more mercury than you should be getting. You're just not getting as much as you're getting typically when you eat out at a restaurant.
So what do researchers hope will come of this study?
Well, from the consumer angle, the researchers are saying, you know, if you eat a lot of sushi, make sure it's not a lot of tuna sushi, you know, eat this tuna sushi in moderation because of the elevated mercury levels. And for the purveyors of the sushi, he's saying they really should be more proactive about putting labels on the sushi they're selling so consumers know what sort of tuna is being used and they can cross-reference that with what types of tuna tend to have more mercury in them.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, for Science Now, we've got a story about how taking a nap may help you learn better, and continuing the neuroscience angle, a story about these brain training games. Maybe you've seen them on mobile devices. Do they actually work? Do they actually help improve cognition? And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the Iceland volcano and how it's impacting science. Specifically, it's having a very large impact, negative impact on scientific meetings and what exactly that impact is. And also a story about the invasive lionfish, which is decimating fish in the Caribbean. The National Science Foundation has just announced a big grant to study and potentially help stop these fish. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the April 23rd, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.